I'm Mark Golub, and in the news, fallout from the violence that erupted after the brutal murder of African-American George Floyd by a Minneapolis policeman, which affected the Jewish community of Fairfax, California, a neighborhood of Los Angeles. Now, there are two stories that need to be understood and paid close attention to in the response to Floyd's murder. The overarching story is that racial inequality in America is still a blight on our nation that stains our nation's idealistic vision that all people are created equal and should have an equal opportunity to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. This is the transcending theme of today. And it doesn't matter how one defines the problem, or the size of the problem, or even the terribly complex social causes at the root of the problem. The reality of America is, it's still better to be white in America than black. And to quote Hillel, all the rest is commentary. And Fox News notwithstanding, the overwhelming number of people flooding the streets of America has been a peaceful expression in the best tradition of America's commitment to the First Amendment rights, that of assembly, that of free speech, and the right to engage in nonviolent protest, even in civil disobedience, in an effort to initiate change in the United States of America. If you're in my age demographic, you remember the heroic, nonviolent ethic of the 1960s that energized the civil rights movement of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and James Forman and Ralph Abernathy and Andrew Young and all the young and older Jews who fought without violence, sometimes enduring horrific violence themselves, even death, in quest of a better America and a true end to slavery. There's something profoundly reminiscent in the message resounding throughout the streets of America today, calling for an end to a society where a black man has more to fear from an American policeman than the exact same person who might happen to be white. And yes, there's rampant oversimplification and a good deal of misleading visuals and inflammatory stories throughout the media, and far, far too much partisanship. And there are gross generalizations regarding the evils of white America, and wild overstatements of police brutality, as if every cop is a violent, racist son of a bitch. Yes, all that's true, but make no mistake, there's something true in the feelings of black America. And there's something deeply inspiring in the idealism being manifest in the streets by Americans of all colors, demanding we find ways to end the degradation of this nation's underclass, the homeless, the mentally ill, the poor, many who are poor through no fault of their own. This is the story of America today. And as Jews who always defend the honest underdog, we must do so now. We must feel the pain and hurt that so many Americans of color live with every day. And then there's a secondary story, and it too needs to be told, honestly, because it's also important for America, and it is critical to us as American Jews. And that story is that groups have used this social movement and moment in time as an opportunity for violence and destruction. It's no less a lie for the media to pretend the violence was insignificant, or to shift the blame to the police, the National Guard, whose sworn duty it is to protect life and property in America. Cities across this nation were imposing curfews to protect life and liberty. Curfews are not imposed for casual acts of violence here and there. Sadly, in the midst of all the idealism, civil, peaceful protests that indeed emerged, an angry, hateful mob. So many do not remember or know history. You know the great George Santayana line, which basically says, those who do not remember the lessons of the past are doomed to repeat it. That's the mob today. And mobs destroy. They never build. There are loving people in the streets. They can build. They can reform. They can help a society become more of what it is committed to be. They can reform. It's not about revolution. It's about reforming. But mobs, whether in the street or in the media, whether there are torches or decrees that obliterate free speech, the mob only tears down. That's what revolutions do. Revolutions devour everyone and everything in their path. And ultimately, ironically, they devour their own. And mobs are never good for Jews. Which is why some of what we've seen in the frenzy is vile expressions of anti-Semitism and anti-Israel behavior. Which brings us to Fairfax, California, where according to some rabbis, Jews have witnessed what they're now calling the Shavuot riots, the worst of the attacks the Jews have seen in that Jewish community and experienced in a long time, maybe ever, and which ironically has fundamentally divided the Jewish community of Los Angeles. Is it true? Have there been Shavuot riots? Or is that story overblown? Well, one journalist has written a great deal about it. He is a journalist with the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's also a blogger whose blog is called Sultan Knish. His name is Daniel Greenfield, who joins us now from California. Daniel, thank you so much for making some time for us on JBS.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk about this difficult issue.
And it is a difficult issue, isn't it, Daniel?
It's a very difficult issue. As you mentioned, there are two narratives. Jews naturally find both narratives compelling. There's their own communal interest. There's the question of the underdog. And there are these dueling narratives. And it's hard for us sometimes to say we should stand up and actually say when we're being punched in the face, because we're very much prone to altruism, to saying that we should put other people first Because those are our values.
Absolutely. All right, I want to talk one moment about you personally, Daniel, and place you for our audience. Where were you born?
I was actually born in Israel, in Eretz Israel. I moved as a child to New York City, and the last few years I've been living in Los Angeles.
When you said you moved to New York City, roughly at what age?
Around 6 years old.
Okay, so did you grow up a New Yorker?
I'm a lifelong New Yorker. You can take the boy out of New York, but...
Daniel, how do you self-identify yourself on the American political spectrum?
Well, I don't particularly like labels, but I definitely lean toward the conservative side.
You know, people who talk about you as if you're on the hard right. Is that fair to you?
I think it's relative. It's a political spectrum, which means to people who are on a certain part of the spectrum, I'm on the far right. To people on the part of the spectrum, I'm a liberal. It's a kind of positional. If you ask me for my views on certain issues, I can tell you that. But asking me to, it's like asking the distance between us. Well, it depends on where you are and where I am.
Well, it's interesting. I don't have a problem self-identifying myself. I consider myself to be an objective, classic Jewish liberal. I am not a progressive, but I am liberal in the sense of what it meant to be a Jew growing up in the 50s and 60s. And I have a liberal orientation. At the same time, it seems to me that much of what I hear and see at the moment has nothing to do with liberal values that I grew up with. And so I consider myself to have been, to be separate from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party in general and this Jewish community as well. So when I ask you the question, I'm hoping for that you have as no more trouble answering it for you than I would for me.
Well, I would certainly say that I'm a conservative. I'm drawn to the more conservative traditions of this country. But obviously that is also somewhat relative. I like to believe that the liberal process can still work, and we live in very much an illiberal time, both right and left, where people are increasingly disinterested in having any kind of dialogue, in coexisting, or in actually finding any kind of common ground. And I think that is really part of what we're seeing in the streets now.
I agree with you, but for me, you've now expressed what I believe are the liberal values that I think America, at one period, and especially American Jews, were deeply and profoundly committed to. And I mentioned in the open, I alluded to the fact that there is horrific censorship now and an attempt to shut down anyone who, I don't know, says something which is not, it's worse, Daniel, than being politically correct. There is sort of a narrative, and if one swerves away from that narrative, one is called hateful, and it seems as if society thinks it has the right to keep that person from being able to write or speak or be part of the dialogue. I don't consider that to be a right-wing or a right-leaning concern. I consider that to be a liberal concern. Do you see it the same way?
I very much agree on that. The question is really, can we coexist? Can we actually have any kind of common ground? The liberal position is just on common ground. The overall one is that we destroy the other side, and we can destroy the other side through censorship, through intimidation, through violence. But the point is, only one side can emerge victorious. That's the liberal position. That's the one really being embraced by both sides these days.
Last question about you, then we move on to the subject at hand. If somebody were to say to you, Daniel, the problem is you have a very strong bias, and it's very hard for you to be objective in any discussion. And as a result, the claim against you is that there's a sensitivity Americans should have, Jews should have, to the plight confronting the Black community of America, and that you might not be sensitive enough because of your bias, and that objectivity and sensitivity are something that is foreign to you. I want you to comment.
Well, I think we hear a great deal from people who are sensitive, but the very idea of sensitivity and objectivity are contradictions. If you're so sensitive, then you already have a bias. You're not really objective. I wish we actually did have more objective journalism. We don't have a great deal of objective journalism. We do have people who have their biases to one side or the other, who are sensitive to one side or the other, which is human nature. And I think we benefit from hearing from both sides.
To what extent, by the way, do you feel that the overall description you heard at the top of this show, which is that it is still better to be white in America than black, and regardless, I mean, I have argued on JBS, it's not a matter of systemic racism in America. I believe it's to the contrary. But I do believe there's social racism. And by that, I don't mean I walk around and here's a Jew and there's a Jew and they're racist, or here's an American and they do racist things. But that in some subtle but very real way, it is better to be white than black in America, and that the cry of the African American community right now is a cry that comes out of that reality. To what extent do you feel that that is an accurate description of what America is today?
I think it's a bit of a generalization. There are contexts in which it's better to be white than black. There are contexts in which it's better to be black than white. And you know, there's a large spectrum within the black community. We're still kind of talking in some ways about black people as if we're just watching an episode of Roots. There is a black upper class. There's a black middle class. There are black people living in Beverly Hills. There are black people whose experiences are very different. For example, take Barack Obama, or take Kamala Harris, who was raised by her Indian mother, and is married to a nice Jewish music executive lawyer and is living in Brentwood. So there are very different experiences, and it's dangerous just to generalize it, just as it's dangerous to generalize all Jews who also come from very different backgrounds. The experience of an Ethiopian Jew or a Russian Jewish refugee or an American Jewish middle class Jew living in Manhattan can be very different.
Boy, I agree 100% with you. And I guess my concern is that it's very easy sometimes for people to only talk about the Barack Obamas and the Kamala Harrises, and you're using them as symbolic of a certain kind of piece of the African-American community. But there is, at the same time, you grew up in New York, there still is Harlem, and there still is Watts, and there still is the drug culture in Baltimore, and there are places throughout the South where it's very hard for an African American to achieve what most white Americans can. And it's not that the system in and of itself is making it hard for them, but the way life is structured, it's hard. And, you know, to what extent do you agree or disagree with that statement?
It's a kind of a complex situation. So I was speaking to an African-American lady a few days ago who thought that the entire situation was completely insane. There are obviously plenty of black people who completely disagree with that. Black people on average do have a lower net worth. They do have lower household incomes. All that is true. They have lower life expectancy. But even how we address those problems can differ quite a bit. If you talk to a conservative African-American intellectual like Thomas Sowell, he very much blames the welfare state. That's not a majority view among the black community, but it is a view. And you know, we kind of, as Jews, we like to applaud our own diversity, two Jews, three opinions. You know, you also do have that in the African-American community where there are more opinions than we kind of see. And when we approach it as white people, as Jews, we kind of tend to have this stereotype. And obviously, when Christians approach us, they tend to have a stereotype of what Jews are. And part of really having a dialogue means looking beyond the stereotypes and actually getting to know a range of people and a range of problems. There are people in the black community who are indeed very upset about police brutality. There are black people who are upset about the fact that they don't have enough policing and that there's more gang violence. At this point, they believe there have been 70 people shot in Chicago over the weekend, including a 13-year-old girl who was killed and a toddler. That's also part of the narrative, and that's the problem. When we actually look at a story, it's complex than the 30-second summary in the news.
I can't agree with you more. And by the way, it pains me that if one does speak to an African-American who doesn't have a hard left position, they are vilified. Anyway, now let's come to Fairfax. So Daniel, you wrote about Fairfax. What happened? And again, I'm asking, I have been cautious about proclaiming anti-Semitism throughout the land. I know I am a lone voice or a voice among the few. So I really want to understand, when I read your piece and you quoted a rabbi of Fairfax saying there was a Shavuot riot, my sense of what happened was it wasn't a riot, Daniel. And I want to know, I want to get your read on it.
So to begin the story, Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, the local chapter, which is co-founded by a woman named Melina Abdullah, who's also acting as its lead organizer, and she has a history of supporting Farrakhan. Now, in the past, Black Lives Matter LA, according with the Nation of Islam, was Farrakhan. I think you and your viewers know quite well, is not very fond of the Jews. He is a bit fond of Hitler. So they coordinated what they called Black Xmas protests. And this had been happening in the past. What they did in the Fairfax area, now just to give your viewers a bit of a picture, Fairfax is at the center of the Jewish community in Los Angeles, certainly the religious Orthodox Jewish community in Los Angeles. But it's also a high-end shopping area. The Grove, which is a very high-end mall, is located there. Now, there's nothing particularly to protest there as far as the police or the government goes. Going there was very much an extension of the Black Xmas protests. They went there. There was a lot of heated rhetoric coming from Melina Abdullah's in the past, has had clashes with the Jewish community, despite having a Jewish father and grandfather. There was the issue of the ethnic studies curriculum over here, which basically erased anti-Semitism and emphasized Islamophobia and blamed Israel. In the past, she'd repeatedly attacked Zionists, attacked Jews as Zionists. So they brought this protest over there. And obviously, there are a lot of people there who are just legitimately trying to speak out about police brutality. But at the same time, there are also all sorts of people there. And we've seen this in the riots before. Professional looters show up. Amateur looters show up. We've had about 100 million in insurance claims from the riots across the country.
Across the country. Okay.
Yes, that's, yeah, not just in the area. But
right.
A huge number. So you have a lot of people coming there for different reasons. You have the Black Hebrew Israelites showing up to these events, who also are racist hate groups. So you have people there who are legitimately there, and you have people there who are kind of a mob. Now, once they actually get to the Grove, which is near Fairfax, and her daughter, Tawanda, give a speech, which they basically all but incite a riot. I would have to read it off to say it properly, but they basically, there's a lot of F words, and there's a lot of, we don't care if this place burns, we don't care if capitalism burns, we don't care if white office workers in office buildings can't get home, and that kind of thing. So they're all but stating we're on board with the riot. And this part is important. When Melina Abdullah explained why she went to Fairfax, she said, "The violence and pain and hurt that's experienced on a daily basis by Black folks at the hands of a repressive system should also be visited upon to a degree to those who think that they can retreat to white affluence." So she's saying the violence and pain and hurt should be visited. That's not exactly a peaceful protest. Now, all this is happening on Shabbat. It's happening on Shavuot. Some synagogues have reopened. Others have not. So some people are actually praying. Others are not praying. And the Los Angeles community, I should add, is also in its own way diverse and mixed. There are a lot of Jews from the Middle East. There are a lot of Sephardi Jews, Moroccan Jews, Persian Jews, who have their own experiences of being attacked by mobs in their own lifetime. For us, this is kind of a theoretical thing. If you're a Moroccan Jew, if you're a Persian Jew, mobs attacking outside your synagogue is not just a story you got from your grandfather. This is a very real thing. At some point, these protests degenerate into violence. Multiple businesses and institutions are graffitied and attacked. That includes eight synagogues and three schools. The statue of Earl Wallenberg, which is in the Beverly Fairfax area, is also vandalized. Now, a lot of this is kind of interchangeable graffiti, but some of it is very clearly targeted at Jews. And the most notable example, the one that has shown up, you have a synagogue called Congregation Beth Israel. And the rioters were able to figure out what it meant as far as Israel went, so they splattered F Israel, Free Palestine on it. At the same time, you have shopkeepers who are now coming back after Shavuot, and they're seeing their stores being witnessed and people shouting at them, effing Jews. So this is really part of the experience that happened at the time. A lot of the graffiti could be cleaned up. But at the same time, there was a discussion happening within the community. How do we react to this?
The ultimate question for you, Daniel, is, and you have a perspective because you've been writing about this and following it. What does this mean, and what should the Jewish response be?
Well, on a purely practical level, if the Jewish institutions are not calling out anti-Semitism when they see it, that's already fundamentally problematic. When you have multiple Jewish institutions tarred with graffiti, when you do have anti-Semitic incidents, at the very least, we should speak out about it. The argument has been that we should not be speaking out because we're interrupting the moment. But America, if it's not a country where you can actually speak out against more than one problem at a time, then there's fundamentally so holy that you can't condemn misconduct when it happens within its ranks. That's also deeply problematic. You should be able to stand for Black Lives Matter. And when there is somebody in Black Lives Matter who is pushing anti-narratives, and when there is a Black Lives Matter protest that results in multiple defacements of synagogues, that's something we should be able to condemn. When we can't condemn that, that is in itself a scary phenomenon.
And by the way, at the moment, people are saying exactly what you say, that they are saying, namely, that even if Black Lives Matter has been in the past anti-Semitic and anti-Israel, and they have taken down certain statements and hidden them inside papers and the papers and paper. When you go on your online, if you want to find the anti-Israel, anti-Semitic statements of Black Lives Matter, you have to really work at it. And there are Jews who say, as a result, leave that issue aside, because there's a greater social issue here, which Jews should be very, very, very at the forefront of, as we have been at the forefront of, and that is making our society colorblind and making it no better to be white than to be black, and that there is an attempt to sensitize American Jewry to the way in which the black community has experienced life over the last X number of years. And as a result, we're told, leave the anti-Semitic part of Black Lives Matter out of it. And you say?
Well, throughout the 20th century, we've been told this repeatedly, that there is a more important cause, a higher cause. During the revolution in Russia, we were told, you know, there's a more important cause. We're fighting for the cause of the working class. We don't have time to talk about anti-Semitism now. When we actually have a perfect utopian society, we can talk about it. And the society that resulted was a quite repressive one, where there was no room to talk about anti-Semitism. We had this during World War II, where we were told the actual winning the war is more important. This is not the time to talk about the Holocaust. Those are extreme examples. What happened here is obviously not on that scale. But at the same time, we've heard this repeatedly, and it seems like sometimes there is never an actual time to talk about anti-Semitism. When can we actually talk about anti-Semitism? There's always going to be significantly bigger issues. There's going to be climate change. There's going to be racism. There's going to be animal rights. There's always a bigger issue. And the problem is, bigger issues, bigger movements often incorporate a component of anti-Semitism, which is really the real problem here. When we actually sign onto a bigger clause, it's important for us to actually say, before we sign on the dotted line, we actually have to talk about the anti-Semitism within the movement, or we actually are not signing onto this. Because when we sign onto this, we're getting a really, really bad deal, and history tells us that.
Daniel, you're doing wonderful work. I hope you continue to write, continue to do your blog, and then from time to time, I hope you let me reach out, pick your brain on JBS. Thank you so much for the work you do, and thank you for making yourself available to me and the JBS community. Kol tuv v'hatzlacha, Daniel. You stay well.
Thank you so much. It's very much my privilege.
Be well. The thoughts of Daniel Greenfield, a fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and his blog is called Sultan Knish. As always, my thanks to our director, Sloan Copeland, to JBS's managing director, Dara Golub, to transmission manager, John McDevitt, and to the producer of In the News, Carol Lilienthal. Until the next time, I'm Mark Golub. Stay safe and be well, my friends.